from the diagram, you can see that we're going to look at a society, some ways of looking at a society. We're thinking of some ways of looking at a Muslim society. So I'd like to just talk about this a little bit, and if you have some input, that's fine. This is really a sociological way of looking at a society. The sociological effects a person from outside, it's what affects a person from outside himself and is specifically caused by the society in which he lives. So we can say, for the Muslim woman, the sociological is that which affects her from outside her society, and it's specially caused by the society in which she is born, in which she lives. Now, I don't tend to look at my own society this way, but I suppose it would be a good thing to do, to consider what are the male roles in the society. You might just have in your mind, if you're going to work among Kurds, then think about it in terms of Kurds. If you are going to work in northwest China among Uyghurs, you might think of that. If you're going to work among Iranians, you might think of it in terms of Iranian society, and so on. Different societies, you can apply this, come up with some slightly different answers, but there will certainly be very different answers from looking at a perhaps an American society, which tends to be focused on the nuclear family, or in Britain we have a disintegration of families, so I don't know how we would make a chart for some parts of that country. But the male roles, what do men do that women don't do? Female roles, what women do that men don't do? There will be certain roles, things that they both do that are common, but there will be individual things which are not. Child-parent roles and old people roles, youth roles, husband-wife roles relating to in-laws. So these are things related to the, not the nuclear family only, but to the extended family. And most of the situations will be extended where there are traditional families. But when you come to think about globalization and urbanization, then you get people moving out of these kind of roles because they come to live in a situation where they're cut off from their roots and their villages and their way of doing things. So some of this is breaking down. But still we can ask of any grouping of people, what are the roles? We might come up with there's no role, or it's they aren't there, or the old people are back in Peshawar, whereas the younger people have moved to Karachi, 1,000 or so miles away. The government roles, how does the government relate to the family? How does it relate to the tribe? How does it relate to the city or the state and the religion? And there varying answers will come up for this for different Muslim societies. For example, I'll start at the bottom, religion. What is the government role in connection with religion? Well, Indonesia is an interesting example where the majority of people are Muslim. It has the largest Muslim population of any country in the world, a total population of 180 million, I think. But it is not a Muslim country in the sense that it's a Muslim organized society. It's not in the sense that it's Islam is actually not the state religion. There are five ingredients for the arrangement for the country as a whole, and it's really a secular state. Someone was born in Indonesia here, or worked in Indonesia. That's how you understand Indonesia. Yeah. So the government in relation to religion in Indonesia will not be the same as the government in relation to religion in Pakistan. So we'll have some different answers. Religion and the government relationship to the state. in a country like Saudi Arabia, state and religion are the same thing. You cannot be a Christian and a Saudi. Because the constitution of Saudi Arabia is the Quran. That's the constitution. The flag, as I mentioned earlier, is there is no God but God and Muhammad is his prophet. This is written on the flag. So the flag of the country has that creed upon it. But there is no liberty for anyone to be anything but a Muslim. So that's the extreme example. There are modifications of that as you go through the Muslim world. Government roles regarding a city. Say take a city like Karachi, which will be a mega city in the early next millennium. It's perhaps 13 million now, but it's going to be heading for 25 million or something before perhaps 20 years are up. There are many cities like this. Cairo is another. So government roles in regard to a city and then to tribes. I can think of an example in relation to tribes when I think of northwest China. There are areas which are semi-autonomous, Uyghurs and Muslim groups. There are about 10 Muslim groups, I think, in that province in northwest China, around Urumqi and Kashgar. So those are government roles in relation to tribal areas and certain provisions which don't apply for the rest of the country. For example, in the question of having only one child, Muslims are allowed in China, I think they're allowed four or at least two. Uyghurs, how many? Two. Uyghurs are allowed two, but the rest are allowed one, right? Okay, yes. I mean, that's officially, you get penalties if you have more than that. But that's a government relationship to certain groups of people which would find it extremely difficult to accept the idea of just having one child, especially if the child were a girl. And government roles in relation to family, we could examine that. It mainly relate to law. Might relate to the age of marriage, and it might relate to the registry of births and things like that. Very difficult. If there's no registry of birth, how do you know how old anybody is? And if there's a rule about minimal age of marriage, how do you deal with keeping that law or rule when there's no punishment if you don't keep it? So these kind of things we would look at there. And then you look at the institutions, the employment patterns. These are very interesting in some areas where things have changed very much. Many Egyptian women go out of their homes to work. It's a different sort of scenario than, say, 30 years ago. Then housing patterns. Housing patterns relating to the size of housing estates and houses within those. Are they catering for the nuclear family or the extended family? And the actual architecture. Architecture plays a large part in Muslim homes. The area for men, the area for women. The extended family with several kind of clusters in one compound. All that kind of thing. Clothing patterns. Yeah, this is quite interesting. These vary. Now, don't think that the veils are just a few types of veils. There are as many designs for burqas or veils as there are for sort of summer dresses. You think of the range of summer dresses perhaps in your town or here in the tremendous range of dresses. Well, there's an equal kind of range for wearing the veil, different ways of doing the patterns and different ways of doing the different parts of it, the colours, all sorts of small, perhaps, but definitely different designs. It's a fashion industry in itself. And it can go to quite interesting extremes. I remember that in the time of Bhutto, Benazir's father, when he was prime minister in Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, they had cocktail parties, which is somewhat unusual, perhaps, for Pakistan, but in Muslim society. But when Zia ul Haq, who was very reformist in a sense, or very Islamic, he introduced what he called a Nizami, what was it called? I've forgotten, but the ordering of society, Nizami Mustafa. Mustafa is a name for the Prophet of Islam. Nizam means organizing of society. So he organized society according to the way of the Prophet. And so instead of having cocktail parties, women had tea parties, and they wore veils, and their general kind of dress was matched by prayer beads, which had the same colors. So your prayer beads matched your dress that you were wearing that day, you see. So it's that's a clothing pattern after all. So we can think about some of that sort of thing. Then friendship patterns. Now this varies considerably, I think, in the Muslim world. The closest ties, are they with the family, or do people have friends? In some languages, there's no really decent word for friend in Urdu, really. It has bad connotations on the whole. So what are the friendship patterns? Obviously, there are some friendship patterns, and they wouldn't all be bad, but still, we have to think about it. Hostility. Feuds. As you heard, I lived for 15 years in the Northwest Frontier Province, where a feud between two families might go on for 100 years. They have to get level, but they never get level. And I'm not unfamiliar with welcoming the head of a family when he's in town visiting. He comes and visits because he's known one of the doctors a long time. So I have ushered into our sitting room a gentleman who won't come in without his gun, and who puts it on the sofa. So he's there, and the sofa's there. He has the gun there, and he always carries it in case he meets his enemy. And then there's the story of one man who was admitted, I think, into Peshawar Hospital, the Christian hospital in Peshawar. He had a gun wound, a bullet to be removed. So he asked the doctor, please, when you take the bullet out, please let me have it. Then I'll know which enemy to kill. So feuds, they go on. And even at a wedding, I can think of the hospital manager, really, in Banu. He came to a local wedding, Muslim man. It was a Christian wedding. And he brought his Kalashnikov and a semi-automatic machine gun. So he was asked, well, why did you bring this? It would be better if you didn't bring this kind of weapon. He said, well, somebody might try to kill the doctor. So I bought it. Then he wasn't allowed to bring it into the hospital, so he used to conceal a knife. In order that he might protect the lady doctor, he was armed always. Anyway, it's not a kind of scenario that we're familiar with, perhaps. But you also, if you're travelling in the Northwest Frontier, if you come to tribal territory, you stick to the road. The hospitality laws extend to anyone travelling on the road. If you go a few yards off the road, then you might get shot. So we used to stick to the roads. There's a code about it. It's good to know the code. The Pakistani superintendent of the hospital where I lived, one day he had two patients, two men, and they said, oh, doctor, we saw you the other day. when you were going through tribal territory. You were coming from Peshawar to Bannu, and we were stopping cars. I mean, what they were doing was robbing cars. So he said, we recognised your car, and so we let you go. So the doctor has to be very generous in probably not taking very much money from these patients, but that was just sort of part of the ordinary chit-chat. Okay. Now, hostility in relation to feuds, families, and sometimes the personal enmity, but then hostility and the state. I think I don't know how I would like to explore that at the moment. I think I'll leave it. Marriage patterns. These vary considerably. As you know, some people, more people are making their own marriage arrangements, but in some societies they are entirely arranged by the family, but in some, family and the people concerned have a say. It's not unusual for bride and groom not to have met each other till the wedding day, but it's... And now, I mean, I know quite a number who are in that situation. Anyway, we have to just look at the institutions in the society. If you're in a Uyghur society, you look at these things and come up with your answers. If you're in a Kurdish society, you look at these things and come up with your answers. If you're from Kenya, then you look up these things in relation to Muslims in Kenya. And they may be different in different parts of the country. They'll be different, for example, in Pakistan, but if you're talking about a backward fundamentalist town like Bannu, it will be different from Karachi, which is an example of almost of not globalization, but urbanization, where lots of these things break down. Educational patterns, this varies. And there are influences that affect it. Zia-ul-Haq, when he became martial law administrator and then president of Pakistan, he replaced English as the second language by Arabic because he thought, in his worldview, Arabic was more important than English. Well, that changed the educational patterns to an extent. It also resulted in a renewed interest in English, because many of the educated Pakistanis were worried that their kids wouldn't know enough English, and English was needed to make progress in the world in general. So there was a burst of institutes for adults to learn English and kindergartens for kids, and it changed the patterns. It changed the actual curriculum in school, but it changed the patterns outside. Well, interesting to know these things. You need to notice them. Health and sanitation patterns. Interest in preventative medicine. Question of one issue that we'll deal with next week is the issue of female circumcision. It doesn't apply to the subcontinent, but it applies very much to parts of Africa and to Egypt, and it does apply down in the Gulf areas. Religious patterns, how do they change? You see Muslims exercising contextualization. I mentioned the service I went to in Los Angeles, where at that service in the mosque, the men sat in front and the women behind, but the women were full participants in the Friday prayers. I sat behind the women, as it were, and not that I wasn't, you know, really at the back, because I wasn't actually participating, I was more observing. But that's contextualization. We would not find a mosque in Peshawar where women would go. We wouldn't find a mosque in Bannu, certainly. I've never been inside a mosque in Bannu, although I've lived there 15 years. I've been inside many mosques, but there are mosques where women worshippers are not allowed, but there are some where women are allowed. But it's often, not always, but certainly in North America, it would be a matter of contextualization. The Muslims would have arrangements for women to participate in Friday prayers. Then we've got transportation patterns. Well, I used to sometimes go by bus from Lahore to Peshawar, and I don't know how there is an effect because I'm a woman. There would be very few women on that bus. There might be two or three or something. They would be put together, and they. If I was to choose a bus, I could choose a Punjab bus or a Frontier bus to go from Lahore in the Punjab to Peshawar in the Frontier. But I would certainly choose a Frontier bus because the Punjab is not so dangerous, so I don't need protection so much in the Punjab. But when I get to the Frontier, I need protection. And so when I get on the bus that was going to Banu, they would recognize me. I could only possibly be going to the Christian hospital because nowhere foreigners live anywhere else. So they would sort of see the flag of the hospital over my head, I suppose, and recognize me as being at least someone going there. And because they were hospitable, patterns of hospitality, you see, they would put me under their hospitality. So I'd be protected. I would be protected right to my front, the front gate. So I wouldn't choose the Punjabi bus. That would get there, but I'd be under no law of hospitality and protection getting there because it's outside the Punjab. Transportation patterns. Well, and also buses sometimes have sections for women and sections for men and that kind of thing. We could go into this at some length. Then the matter of immigration and migration patterns. Now, I can give you a practical example. I followed the Pakistani migration to the Gulf oil countries because nurses and doctors and also road builders, illiterate people, not very educated people, and very educated people took jobs from Pakistan. There must be a million Pakistanis or more in the Gulf. Indians came. Some of them came from Kerala, which is the most literate state in India and the most Christian state in India. And because they spoke English well, and Kerala's not far across the sea to the Gulf, many, many people came from there. It was a kind of migration, not to live forever because they couldn't get visas for that, but for working on for 3 years or 6 years or 2 years or something like that. But then I found, as I looked at migrations, I found that the Pakistanis, some of them went to Jordan and they went to Syria, but particularly Jordan, and that was not a straight migration. That was a replacement migration. Now, a replacement migration is when, say, the Jordanians, who were quite well-educated, quite a well-educated Arab country, Jordan, they took jobs in Saudi and got good jobs, better jobs than they can get in Jordan. So the Pakistanis came to Jordan to take over those jobs as bank clerks, nurses, doctors, and so on. Replacement migration, it's a different thing. Well, these things bear looking at, and you can get a prognosis of about migrations. So some of this sort of thing is a way of looking at a society. In the 1970s, asked the economists, what do you think is going to happen in the 80s in the Gulf? And they said, oh, there's going to be a Far Eastern connection, and we'll have Filipinos, and we'll have Koreans, and some people from the Far East will come, because their labour may be cheaper than the Pakistanis and Indians who are there. And so that's what they forecast, and that is what happened. So it's useful to look at these different things if you're thinking of certainly a long-term work in a certain area. Birth patterns. That's important. I'm going to talk about birth and death and the sort of customs, but these patterns should be looked at as well. Birth control and population planning, we'll look at that. And death and burial patterns. Even poor Pakistani families, if someone dies, one young man I knew died in Cyprus, Christian, Pakistani, I mean, the family flew the body back to... I hope that when I die, if I die in Cyprus, that my body won't be flown back anywhere. I think I've made my wishes known. But the pattern, it'd be very difficult for, this, say, this was a 33-year-old husband with three children. The patterns are that he should be buried back in Pakistan. Personally, I would say, well... I mean, from my perspective, well, it's cost a lot to get him back. He could be buried very cheaply here, and there are these three children and this widow, you know. But the patterns are not always the same. And then we should also look at the rites. What shall I say? R-I-T-E-S. The death and burial patterns relating to how people are buried. See, Muslims want to know not only what you believe, but what you do. And you can preach the good news from burial customs just as well as you can preach the good news from 1 Corinthians 15. But being Westerners, most of us, I think, we would probably want to preach from 1 Corinthians 15, but it might be much more effective if we preached it from some of the customs. Because they may say, well, I've been asked this, you know, what do you do? There was a bad accident not long ago in Banu, outside Banu, and one of the young men that I was giving regular Bible teaching to, he came rushing to see if I was involved in that accident. And, well, I wasn't. But so then four Christians were killed. So then and the funeral service had just taken place. He asked me, how do you bury and what do you do? So I had to go into a lot about the actual way that people are prepared for burial and what the customs were. And I was able to do 1 Corinthians 15 all right, but his point of interest were the rites and the patterns. Okay, so for many reasons we should look at societies. And so I invite you to think of the particular society that you are interested in. And if you're not, well, that's okay. You can choose one, or you can think about it in general, and face these matters. It goes on for a long time, but you'll find that it's very useful to know a Muslim woman's perception of what affects her from outside herself, and what specifically. And how is she's particularly influenced by the society in which she lives. So it's very important to think of some ways of looking at a society. There are other ways of looking at a society, but this is a beginning. So it's the end now for us.